This is Pure Decking for That's an awesome satellite photo, are you? I'm sure it's shopped, but I think it's awesome. Where was I? This is the show about read the fucking line. This is Pure Decking, show number 463 for Thursday, January the something, the 20th. 2017. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and admitting that I have absolutely no understanding at all of how Instagram influencers make money. I truly don't understand it. I feel like everyone just hates them, but I don't get it. So, I found some tequila in the back of the refrigerator, some Patron that must be drank for reasons. Madman, what's up?
All right, so I'm going to explain this, Morps. There's this small segment of the population that are vapid, attractive women with nice breasts. And they get on Instagram, and then they don't actually make money off of Instagram. They make money off of taking baths and selling this water to idiot men who are willing to give them money.
That's a good answer.
Now, the idiot men find out about them because they're on Instagram showing their tits. And everyone likes to see tits. But these idiots don't realize that you can see other tits for free and you don't have to buy bath water. And I don't know why they would want to do that anyway when all you really want is...
So I spent some time on the Choosing Beggars subreddit, and there's apparently a lot of people who talk about how many influencers they have wanting free shit from people. And it's just like, I don't understand how this works, because who the fuck cares? So that's where that came from, if you want to know. It's like, you know, no, I kind of get the idea that you're using it as free advertising for your OnlyFans. I get that. What I don't get is the people who talk about, oh, I have so many followers, give me free shit. It's like, no. So, and we have an Are You?
I'm looking forward to going back to a time when you're famous for doing something. You're not famous for being famous.
So you want to go back to the 1990s then?
Yeah, I mean, even the sports ball players I don't care about, like Michael Jordan, he accomplished something. He got great at something. Now, I don't care about basketball, but he was at least great at that. So you could admire him and how he got famous. Any musician, they learn to play a fucking instrument. I don't care if they're playing an instrument in a genre of music that you don't like. They developed a skill.
Very true. That is very true.
An Instagram influencer? No, fuck you. Why should I care what you think? You get famous for doing something, and then you get influence.
You're homesick for a world that doesn't exist anymore, man.
I think I'm homesick for a world that never existed, except outside of, tabletop games. I
found out you can play a tactical wheelchair in D&D these days.
That's awesome. Yeah. Actually, I was thinking about it the other day. I do get nostalgic for some of the old games we used to run around in, right? Of course, this is how Minecraft is still going, but... you know, like even logging into Second Life the other day, just out of boredom and curiosity to see if, you know, what it's like now. And it's like, oh God, the load times are still God awful. Why am I doing this to myself? So.
Hey, you can do it in the meta soon, dude. Go play in the meta.
I will not log into the Lizard's reality. I'll go play D&D on Tabletop Simulator first.
I'll wait for somebody to come up with the open source version that's better. And have I talked about it on Decking? I know we've talked about it, of what I think you need to do if you actually want a metaverse to work? Because it ain't one company fucking running it.
Well, no, we all know it's not going to work the way they say it's going to work.
No, it's... Arthur Jones take on it that, yeah, Second Life was better. Well, Cykros, I don't know if you were... you may not have been here last week when we did an article that was literally a Second Life article from 2010 where somebody was just switching out Second Life for Metaverse. And, I mean, I was laughing pretty good at it. I felt like the other group, rest of the group enjoyed it. So, okay, yeah, so you heard that. Okay, cool. It's just like, no, if you actually want some kind of a VR metaverse to succeed, you need to structure it more like web servers or email, where at least the protocols are open and well understood. And, you know, then you can write whatever you want, whether it's open source or closed source or whatever. But that way it's just whatever headset or VR interface, or not even VR, just, you know, whatever software you're using can interact with it. And, you know, maybe you'll have some kind of an inventory server that either you can run your own or somebody else, you know, somebody will host it for you. But that's, you know, nobody's going to build that right away because companies want to own this shit. So, anyways, whatever. I think Facebook is just going to kill the concept, which, admittedly, having read Snow Crash may not be the worst thing in the world. So,
I want to run my own inventory server. It'll make it easier to dupe items. I will have all the orange ones, even if they're useless.
It's fine. Well, I mean, and that's where you do get into shit like what Second Life was doing with, where they had the open simulator where you could run third-party clients and third-party hosting and run your own, or, you know, and then where your inventory lived, because they actually had some of that working in OpenSim back in the day where you would log into one instance, but you could actually, you know, teleport into other instances running the same software just on somebody else's server. And it didn't work great, but they kind of had it working. So, I don't know, maybe somebody will pick that up and run with it again. Ain't going to be me. I'm not good enough at coding. So, anyways. So, but it's like a job at a computer. Oh, congrats. Good job. So, anyways, first article here is from Business Insider. The IRS will start using facial recognition this summer, and you'll have to send it off a selfie if you want to pay your taxes online. they get some bullet points here. The IRS will require users of its online portal to create an ID.me account from summer of 2022. ID.me is a digital identification company that requires selfies from users for facial recognition. Last bullet point, landed numerous contracts with U.S. state governments and over the course of the pandemic. So this is a third-party company that's contracting with the IRS for their online filing system. So,
yeah, because none of this can go wrong.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, man. Hey, Madman, is your payroll thing cleaned up yet?
Oh, no, that's okay. Never going to get fixed.
I just point in case, okay?
So here we go. The Internal Revenue Service is going to require users of its online tax payment services to create an identification account, which will involve sending off a selfie for facial recognition. Security blogger Brian Krebs was the first to spot a message on the IRS website directing users to create an account with a company called ID.me. Quote, if you have an existing IRD username, please create a new ID.me account as soon as possible. We're bringing you an improved sign-on experience. You won't be able to log in with your existing IRS username and password starting in the summer of 2022, the message read. Creating an ID.me account involves submitting various pieces of official documentation as well as taking a live video selfie. So not just a picture. So you can't just, you know, take a picture of your dick. You have to wag your dick in front of the camera. Actually, I should probably not advocate sending dick pics to the IRS. I mean, come on.
I mean, it's tempting.
I'm not the only one who was thinking it, right?
It's tempting.
You know, or, you know, along the same lines as the Australian check-in system where they wanted you to take a picture and send it to them every 15 minutes or whatever to make sure you were at home.
That didn't last long.
When somebody starts seeing this stuff, people are going to lose their mind.
Or the self-reporting COVID where they just, you know, reported government officials instead of themselves.
That's pretty good.
Don't forget the googly-eyed bandits running around. It's falling apart.
Yeah, because we know your politicians take your criticism ever so well. Not that ours do any better. Let's see, where was I? IRS spokesperson confirmed to Gizmodo that users will need an ID to ME account to make and view payments and access their tax records. The Department of the Treasury did not immediately respond when contacted by Insider. ID.me offers digital identification services and was able to land contracts with U.S. states governments over the course of the pandemic, Bloomberg reports. One user told Bloomberg that they ran into significant problems trying to send off a selfie to ID.me as the app failed to recognize her face and then locked her out for 72 hours at a time. Well, depending on what algorithm these guys are using for their face detection, because you know it's not a person sitting there reviewing it, historically, there have been problems with AI systems recognizing faces of people of minority status. I'm specifically thinking of the Xbox Kinect and black people, but I mean, you know, if you, it's not like that problem's gotten a lot better. I know some.
Depending on your sample group, these guys are going to be blind.
I mean, you know, I'm hoping somebody's tested shit like that. I'm just saying.
And I love how making it harder to sign in is making a better customer experience.
Well, the thing is, it's still going to come down to a username and password, right? So, okay, sure, they've got a video selfie and all this documentation on you, which kind of makes sense if you're dealing with the government. Sure, fine. Except it's still a username and password, right? So after you've gone through all the rigmarole to set up the account, what prevents me from stealing your login by putting a keylogger on your machine?
My video selfie of my penis? You can't steal my penis, Morps. You're not a voodoo doctor.
Oh, there's a callback. Okay. Yeah, Bloomberg also found a log of complaints lodged against ID.me by users with the California Employment Development Department. One complaint involved a transgender user who was blocked from accessing state benefits because the gender stated on their driver's license and their passport didn't match. Well, yeah, you know, if somebody is doing the transgender thing and getting all their paperwork to line up, probably would trigger a lot of the anti-fraud stuff, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because you're a dude, and now you're saying you're a chick. So, do you know how chicks that want to pretend to be dudes do that? They do exactly what you're doing.
So. Oh, wow. Is my connection going to shit? What's going on here? Ping looks all right, but I'm getting some packet loss. That's strange. Hope our TeamSpeak server is not taking a shit, because everything else seems like it's working okay.
You're coming through to me, okay?
Yeah, it seems so fine going out.
Okay, well, it's probably
and
just me.
Now there's another third party holding on to your info that you didn't need holding on to your info because the IRS is lazy.
Well, pretty much. I wish they would have at least went with like one of the mainline companies that does this shit, like Okta or, you know, something. But those companies are expensive, so, you know, because they actually know what the fuck they're doing. Well, that, and I'm sure ID.me is one of these companies that was set up specifically for government contracts. Because every time I've looked into it, that's a different class of company because they are set up specifically for government contracts and usually nothing else. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's kind of dumb. And, you know, a lot of people just use TurboTax and shit like that anyway. So is that going to affect TurboTax and stuff like that? Am I going to have to go make a ID.me account if I'm using one of these other services, or is it still going to go through their service like nothing? Because I'm sure they've got, you know they've got back-end agreements for filing this stuff electronically and shit. So.
I don't see how they could force that, because they're still allowing paper filings. So I could just go out and fill this stuff out myself instead of doing it digitally.
Yeah, you could, and just drop it in the mail and do it that way. I mean, sure, nothing prevents you from doing that. It's kind of inconvenient, but you can.
So. Well, I'll give it to them. Their actual CEO has done something in his life. He'd win a Bronze Star.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's credited for saving 20 men lives.
Oh, so he's former military. So, well, yeah, that makes sense. There you go. He's built his company specifically for government contracts because he knows the game. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. You got a Bronze Star, which is a lot better than most other CEOs have ever fucking done.
Cool. All right. Well, let's do this next one here. This is from torrentfreak.com. Ad blocking does not constitute copyright infringement, court rules. Summary here, Axel Springer has lost its copyright infringement lawsuit against IO GmbH, the company behind Adblock Plus, the German publishing house that owns the Bild and Die Welt brands, among others, claimed that ad blocks interfere with the presentation of websites and web browsers, thus breaching copyright. In a victory for IO, the Hamburg District Court has dismissed the case. Thank goodness for that, because it's a dumb argument. In order to finance their operations, millions of websites rely on advertising to generate revenue. For some readers, however, the excessive or intrusive advertising is something to be combated, even often through the use of ad-blocking tools. Well, if all these damned ad services wouldn't load drive-by fucking malware, it still happens to this day. It hasn't been as common, or at least as written about, but it still fucking happens a lot. I wouldn't be telling everyone to put Adblock on their system. Adblock, Ghostery, NoScript. I mean, sorry, but, you fill your websites with shit, don't be surprised when people start putting filters in, right? Developed by a German company, IO GmbH, and available on Firefox, Chrome, Safari, Android, and iOS, one of the most popular tools is Adblock Plus. It's able to drastically reduce the volume of advertising seen by users that didn't sit well with publishing giant Axel Springer. Also, saves a lot when you are on a metered plan, on a fucking cell phone, or 4G connection, 5G connection. The other nice thing that they do is they make a lot of websites usable. Some websites are so covered up in ads that they're basically unusable without Adblock installed, because they're just constantly popping up more pop-ups, and it's insane. So, the ad companies only have themselves to blame for people doing Adblock. It's because they've made the damn thing so obnoxious that, Anyways, the publisher, which owns Bild and Die Welt, among others, claimed that Adblock Plus and its users interfere with its business model, so in response took legal action to bring that to an end. After trips through regional courts and eventually Germany's Supreme Court, in April of 2018, Adblock Plus and IO came out on top, having been found not in breach of competition law. After its defeat by earlier action, in 2019, Axel Springer filed a new lawsuit on new grounds. This time, the publisher claimed that Adblock Plus, quote, changed the programming code of websites, thus directly accessing the legally protected offer of publishers, unquote. In other words, Adblock Plus breaches copyright. IO immediately dismissed the allegations as almost absurd, noting that its browser-side tool does not attempt to modify anything on Springer servers. Nevertheless, Springer pressed ahead with its legal action, claiming that by interfering with website delivery to viewers, that constituted copyright infringement and was worthy of an injunction. In its lawsuit, Axel Springer cited a 2012 court ruling that found that software for Sony's PlayStation Portable console that changed code in memory to facilitate cheating was infringing. In that case, the court found that the temporary modification of the software constituted a revision of the software, something which required permissions from rights holders. Oh, we missed that one in 2012 because that sounds fucking dumb. I mean, because you're not distributing it. You're running it in RAM, and it disappears when you turn the console off. In this case, there were no claims that AdBlock Plus changed or manipulated any copyrighted works. Instead, Springer claimed that software interferes with how the copyrighted content is displayed in a browser. Well, by that logic, anyone who owns a broken TV is in copyright infringement. According to a judgment handed down by the Hamburg Regional Court, that in itself is not enough to determine copyright infringement by AdBlock Plus or its users. In a decision handed down Friday, the court finds that Axel Springer is not entitled to injunctive relief pursuant to Section 91 URHG, since there was no unauthorized duplication and or reworking of copyrighted computer programs as defined in copyright law. Quote, the defendants have not infringed on the plaintiff copyrights to the programs for creating the web page. The defendants are not, together with the respective user, accessories to a copyright infringement, unquote, the decision reads. According to the court, the HTML files and other elements are loaded in the user's main memory when Axel Springer-controlled web pages are accessed, but that takes place with the publisher's consent. Users who access those pages and also use AdBlock Plus are also entitled to store these files, since when the files are transferred, there's an implied agreement for the user to do so. Furthermore, while AdBlock Plus changes the structure of how websites are presented in a browser, the tool doesn't change any code, only what the code does. Ultimately, the court found that the processes carried out by AdBlock Plus following the local saving of the website do not constitute a reworking under copyright law. Only a change in the program's substance can be considered infringing. So what they're saying is that because AdBlock doesn't actually change anything in the website, it just prevents URLs from loading, that you're not actually changing anything, you're just preventing it from, you know, running in a certain way. So you're changing the environment, not the code, is what they're saying. Which, that bothers me because that's really thin.
Yeah.
The logic they're using here is really, really thin. I would have preferred a statement of, well, you're modifying it in memory, so it's not really a new distributed copy. It's just, and they're not redistributing it, so, you know. Anyways, the court notes that the rulings otherwise represent a disproportionate encroachment on users' freedoms to make various choices, including not to load images to save bandwidth, to deactivate JavaScript, or block pop-ups or tracking elements. It would also render transition tools and aids for visually impaired people as copyright infringement. So, okay. In a statement published this morning, IO said that it has repeatedly defended the rights of internet users, software developers, and publishers, and is happy the decision represents a win for a free and secure internet. Quote, the Hamburg Regional Court sets an important precedent here. No company has the right to prohibit users from setting their own browser settings. The ruling also gives many companies the legal certainty they need to continue developing applications that change users' lives for the better, unquote, says IO CEO Till Fadia. While the case is now dismissed, Axel Springer has already announced its intention to appeal the decision. That will take place in the Hasinic Higher Regional Court, which previously ruled on the PlayStation Portable cheating case. So, they're still trying.
Oh, they'll keep trying too, man. This isn't the last time we'll hear about this.
Well, if they win, that's the scary part is if they win this and get it to say, okay, you're doing copyright infringement by running a fucking ad block, the next thing it's going to be, oh, you're doing copyright infringement by not accepting our cookies. Oh, it's copyright infringement because you don't have telemetry enabled. Oh, it's copyright infringement because you're not letting our app track you. I mean, where does it end?
That's what I mean. This fight's going to go on. I mean, next thing it'll be for your safety.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't like it. I don't like this stuff. I'm glad the court came to the right decision, but I think their reasoning is weak.
Yeah.
I don't like this idea that an in-memory copy of the code is considered a copy, because they're saying with PlayStation Portable, modifying it in memory is, you know, a step too far because you're making a new revision of it. except you're not. It's in memory. It's not saved to disk. It's not being published. It's not, you know, it's sort of like saying if I bought a copy of Dune and scribbled in some of the pages and ripped out some of the others and then put it back on my shelf, I'm guilty of copyright infringement because I've made a new revision that the author didn't consent to. Okay, I guess technically true, but nobody cares.
No. just because no one cares doesn't make it technically true. You know what I mean? Legally,
yeah.
No one might care about it, but legally.
Well, one slight flaw in your analysis is with Doom, you actually paid for it. With this one, you're blocking the revenue, so you didn't actually pay for it. The implied contract with going to these websites are, we're going to show you this content for free, but you're also going to have to look at our advertisers. Now, I will concede they're not holding up their end by making those advertisements safe, so you can have an argument, while you're not making these advertisements safe for my computer, I shouldn't have to load them, but you're also then not paying for the content. Now, the only real fair way I can see on this is just start putting everything behind paywalls. If you want to read an article, you have to start paying for it again.
Or just accept that if you're going to use the business model of advertisement-based funding, understand some people are going to run things like Adblock, and some people... I don't use Forbes for decking stories anymore. Anytime I come across a news site where if I try to load it and it comes up and says disable your ad block to continue, I just don't use the story.
Find it somewhere else or check the archives.
Or just a lot of times I just don't use it. Just go find something else to talk about. Because it's not that I want to deprive them of revenue, right? It's that there have been too many instances of malware, drive-by downloads, and simply poorly performing ads that, you know, I run some pretty beefy systems because I'm me, but how many people out there are just using, you know, an iPad, a Chromebook, some cheap sub-$300 Windows machine they got off the shelf at Walmart, right? And they go to a web page that's covered in ads and JavaScript and tracking and stuff like that. And, I mean, the thing is unusable because it brings their computer to a halt because it's trying to load all this shit. But you install things like Adblock, you install things like NoScript, and suddenly the web page is not only usable, but it's fast. I mean, it's amazing when you take an older machine and put some of these, you know, like for family. I've had to do this for family a couple of times now where you know, get them off, you know, Internet Explorer and put Firefox and then put uBlock and a few other things on it, and their 3 or 4 year old machine is suddenly brand new again, fast on the web, and everything works so much better. I've had to do that for several members of my family so many times now that it's just like, I mean, of course you put AdBlock on a machine because the internet's not hardly usable without it.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's. And Madman has a point that the implied agreement is that you're getting these ads loaded on your page to help fund the content. You're right. That is the implied agreement. But they've made it so onerous to do so, they shouldn't be surprised that people are taking measures to get control of their machines back. In a lot of cases, though, if the ads are that bad, I just won't use the site. And that's, you know, of course, that's the choice. But I just say it's a risk of doing business if you're going to go with an advertiser-supported model that some people aren't going to like your ads. Either they'll skip them, they won't load them through a plugin, or, you know, they'll never click on them. And that's part of it. And you also have to accept that, you know, if you're to the point where you're using some of the... it's like what we did for Dojo last week where we had all the dark UI patterns and how many times they try to trick you to click on ads...
Yeah.
I mean, if you're, you know, you should stop and think, if you're resorting to loading the ads under the mouse cursor with JavaScript so that you'll accidentally click on one, you know, so that you can get a little bit of revenue from it, you need to stop and look at what you're doing. You know, it's like, wait a minute. You know, it's like, stop, think about it for a second, go, am I the butthole? I mean, you know. It's like, yes, yes, if you're building websites that are trying to load all these pop-unders and trick people into clicking on links to get some ad revenue, yeah, you're the asshole. So, you know, and that's why people use Adblock. So, anyways, I'll give you the last word on that one, Madman, then we'll go to the next one.
Well, the tricky UIs we were discussing, I haven't actually seen those with ads. I've seen those with people trying to download add-ons. I think that's crap, having you try to download shit. But I haven't actually seen that with an ad before.
Really?
Usually the ads are just either pop-ups or video cut-ins.
You never used two cows without Adblock then, did you? yeah, that was a common thing with a lot of the old download sites, is that you'd have the actual download link somewhere in the middle of the page, and about five or six banner ads that said download now that would load in the page.
I didn't really dive that deep into piracy either, so I didn't have to worry about that particular bit of trickery to get revenue.
It wasn't just piracy, it was like shareware and freeware stuff too. SourceForge, for God's sake, had it. But anyways, but you're right, not every website does that, so you know,
I think it's just going to end up falling back to a paid model. You're going to need to start subscribing to things. I've unfortunately started doing that, but I get things ad free, but I'm also limiting my news inputs now. I'm less rounded than I used to be.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I know we seem to hit the talking points each day. What's happening?
I mean, I still try, but whenever I mean, like you're that, paying, you're still viewing fewer things, because I'm not going to pay for everything.
That fantastic article earlier about female sailors.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
There's still good free stuff out there. And Substack. Substack's worth having a look at if you're into serious news.
I've heard that one a few times. I've been meaning to look at it. I haven't done it, though.
Yeah, there's some good writers over at Substack. Yeah, I've been venturing there more and more lately.
Well, if you don't let them do their advertising, they won't stay free, though.
Some of the Substack you have to pay for.
Psychros in the IRC. Just use the bypass paywalls, ad block, and all the other add-ons. Let the normies with their compromised systems fund it all.
That's the spirit.
Free riders are a thing. I'm not going to complain. I've been a free rider on many things for a while.
Well, and that's kind of what my point was, is if you're going to go with that model, you just have to accept there's going to be a handful of free riders. Because otherwise, you're going to...
Well, I watched a couple of, say, medium-sized podcasts try behind the paywall and quickly came back out from behind the paywall, if you follow my drift.
The statistics I've always heard is if you try to go with a listener-funded podcast or user-supported thing or even something like throwing up a Patreon or something like that, the stat you're supposed to use is 10% of your audience will actually fund you. So, and then you expect, like, on average, like $1 a month or something like that out of people who are willing to fund you.
So, I mean, the internet aristocrats an anomaly then.
Yeah, some of them...
A large anomaly.
That's, you know, some are better than others, but the number I've always seen when you're trying to estimate that is 10%.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much of an anomaly, because I've never given him money.
Oh, dude, he has a lot of free riders, don't get me wrong. I've never given the man a cent. And but I watched the donations come in on his last live stream. I estimated easy 30 grand.
Well, you also have to think, too, in that 10%, you might have one or two people who are willing to significantly support.
Yeah, one of the other ones I listened to, he probably averages maybe $1,000 a stream.
Sure.
And there's a few $100 donations in that grand.
Oh, sure. You go look at some of these Twitch people who are, you know, they'll have, you know, a handful, you'll have several thousand people in there, and they've got a handful of people, you know, giving them the $5, but you'll have a lot of them in there who they've set up these things with their live stream where the donations make noise or they react to it in some way. And, you know, so you got people in there who are, because we were talking about the other day where I had watched some clip of, because there were I was fascinated for a little bit about these VTubers who were like doing this digital puppetry. And it's like, how are they fucking doing this? Where they're animating a character, and it's doing that. And you look into it, and there's actually some pretty cool technology behind it with facial recognition. Some people were using phones and things like that. But when I was looking up, because it was all in bits, I'm like, well, what's a bit? And then you look it up, and it's like somebody just paid $5 to an anime cartoon girl to play a sound effect while they were talking about a video game.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like, wow. So I imagine most people aren't doing that, but you only need a couple of people to do it. To make your $1,000 a stream, right?
Oh, if you want to get creative too, I saw one stream top donation got an insult. if you donated the, I think it was $100 or something like that, it played an insult of the show host. You could insult the show host for $100.
Yeah,
interrupt the show. Yeah, and give the host shit for $100 and. Like flies to honey, dude. Well, fucking trolls can't help himself.
In the video I was talking about where people were playing sound effects, one of the sound effects was just somebody screaming dicks, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. And of course, you know, the character is acting all insulted or mad that they're doing that, but they're giving him a couple of bucks to play it every time. And, yeah. You know, they're like acting like they're having this big argument with their audience and they keep playing the sound effect. And, you know, acting all mad and insulted about it, but it's like, you're getting money every time they do it. I know what you're doing. You're sitting there trying to keep them doing it. It's like, oh, no, I'm insulted. Please stop showering me with your money. Yeah.
Stop throwing the shekels at me. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Please, no more money, Daddy. Oh, it hurts.
So, I don't know, man. But, yeah, 10% is the number I've always heard, but I'm sure it varies based on, you know, if you've got a scheme going to get more people doing it, you know, insulting the host or you know, playing a sound effect or, you know, so you get more people into it. What's Cycros say? Knows geopolitics and empire is looking at figuring out a new way to monetize. Patreon isn't cutting it. Pretty bad when you can't cover the cost of living in Mexico. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, too. For every one of these guys who does well on it, there's probably, you know, 1,000 who don't. And that 10% number is more like, you know, zero, because nobody thinks what they're worth doing.
Okay, the average podcast career will put out one episode. That is it.
Oh, well, we're doing pretty good then.
Dude, you look at it, most of them start, and if they haven't got any grounding in it to start with, or haven't come from another show, they've got no idea what they're doing. I mean, it took me forever to figure out what the fuck I was doing, dude.
You know? Yeah, but I mean, we've got
I have a lot of help.
We've got 300-ish episodes. Do we have that? How many episodes of IHN do we actually do?
Counted. It was easy, 350.
Was it 350?
Yeah, because you got to remember the reboot went for 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually still up on the G15 front page, too.
Oh, well, it was rebooted before that.
We rebooted it. We tried it a couple of times.
You know, I got 20,000 hours, I'd say.
Yeah.
Easy.
And then, of course, this is 463 on decking, so I mean.
Yep. Plus all the other shows we've done.
Yeah.
Plus crossovers with Kia Studios.
Yeah.
Yeah. The average dude starts a show, does one episode, figures out, holy shit, that took a long time to get 30 minutes of content. Now I've got to edit it.
And this is why we don't edit it.
And then they'll sit there and they'll critique it themselves and then just go, oh, I can't put this out. It's terrible. And they'll never do it again. But unless you're incredibly like, who am I trying to?
Narcissistic.
So, yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the dude. It'll come to me.
There's plenty of them, so
Dark Side Phil. Dark Side Phil is so fucking arrogant, he's still going today. Right? The man's made millions of dollars, pissed it all away, and he's still e-begging today for money. He's probably doing a show right now.
Well, I mean, hell, we've been doing shows for a couple, you know, a decade and a half now and never made a cent off of it. So,
yeah. It was one of my goals, man. I'd say that goal's been correctly done.
There you go.
What's the next story in the list, boys?
Next story is from TechCrunch. And it's they actually wrote up a bit of a summary over some of the libraries getting fucked with, the open source libraries getting fucked with. And I was waiting for somebody to put together a nice summary of it because it's kind of hard to put it all together from forum posts and GitHub comments and things like that. So this one is, most people don't realize it, but many of the devices and apps you use every day are built on top of open source software, maintained by one or two developers that aren't paid for their time, who patch bugs and improve their code to give back to the community or as a passion project. Take curl, for example, or CURL. A library that makes it simple for software to access data in another system, such as in an API. The library is used in practically every modern connected device, from iPhones to cars, smart fridges, and TVs. Yet it's essentially being maintained by a single developer, Daniel Steinberg, for free for almost three decades, despite many open source projects being included in for-profit software and devices, generally without compensation outside of a simple acknowledgement, the system works mostly reliably. Some open source developers are able to successfully support their work through programs like GitHub sponsors or Buy Me a Coffee, maintenance contracts with companies, or taking a job at a company that pays them to maintain their library, but this is far from the norm. These systems' inequity is often revealed when there's a widespread security breach, such as the Log4Shell vulnerabilities that emerged in the Log4j Java library in December of 21, which sucked. I don't know if anybody else had to deal with that shit, but it sucked. Because do you know where Log4j is? Every fucking where. It's in every flipping major Java project. Oh my god. Catalog where Log4j is in your network. It'd be quicker to catalog where it's not. Anyways, it's triggering a slew of critical security vulnerability bulletins that affected some of the largest companies in the world. Developers of the affected library were forced to work around the clock to mitigate the problems without compensation or much acknowledgement that their work had been used for free in the first place. Curl's developer experienced similar behavior with companies depending on his project, demanding he fly out to help them when they face trouble with their code, despite not paying him for his services. Well, I mean, that's where you start coming up with creative ways to tell them to go fuck off.
Yeah.
If you want me to fly out there and help you, I will. It's going to be $1 million.
Yeah, you just start billing them for time, right? As a result, it shouldn't be a surprise that when some open source developers are beginning to realize they wield outsized power despite lacking the compensation they receive for their work because their projects are used by some of the largest, most profitable companies in the world. In early January, for example, Merrick Squires, the developer of two popular NPM packages, that's JavaScript and Node.js specifically, Colors and Faker, intentionally introduced changes to their code that broke their functionality for anybody that used them, outputting liberty, 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 followed by gibberish and an infinite loop when used. That's kind of funny. While Squires didn't comment on the reason for making the changes, he had previously said on GitHub that I am no longer going to support Fortune 500s and other smaller-sized companies with my free work. Squires' changes broke other popular projects, including Amazon's Cloud Developer Kit, as his libraries were installed almost 20 million times per week on NPM, with thousands of projects depending directly on them. Within a few hours, NPM had rolled back the rogue release, and GitHub suspended the developer's account in response. While NPM's response was to be expected after previous incidents in which malicious code was added to libraries and ultimately rolled back to limit the damage, GitHub's was a new one. The code hosting platform took down Squire's entire account, even though he was the owner of the code and it was his right to change it as he pleased. This isn't the first time a developer has pulled their code in protest either. Developer of LeftPad pulled his code from NPM in 2016, breaking tens of thousands of websites that depended on it following a fight with the Kit Messenger over the naming of another open source project he owned. What's astonishing is that despite the occasional high-profile libraries protesting the way the industry works, these types of incidents aren't all that common. Open source developers continue to work for free, maintaining their projects as best they can, even though multi-million dollar products are being created off the back of their work. Even the White House has acknowledged the importance of open source software to the technology industry after meeting with industry leads following the Log4j incident, saying in January 2022 that open source software brings unique value, has unique security challenges because of the breadth of its use and the number of volunteers responsible for its ongoing security maintenance. Yet, despite the declaration, massively popular open source software is still woefully underfunded, at least until it gains a spotlight. Before the Heartbleed vulnerability put the wider internet at risk, the affected open source project, OpenSSL, received just $2,000 per year in donations, which grew to $9,000 after the issues came to light. The team behind OpenSSL, which is used by practically every modern networking device, wrote at the time that there should be at least half a dozen full-time OpenSSL team members, not just one, able to concentrate on the care and feeding of OpenSSL. Instead, the project team continues to find contract work to cover the cost of maintaining the project. Developers could change their open source license, turning their work into products, or hustle for more sponsors, but there's no one-size-fits-all for every project. Until the industry figures out a better way to fund all of this free work, which nobody seems to be forthcoming about, we should expect more open-source developers to perform acts of disobedience, intentionally breaking their work to shine light on what they're contributing. This isn't just suitable in the long run, or this just isn't sustainable in the long run, but it isn't clear how we're going to get out of the mess, as the use of open-source balloons in every piece of software connected and every connected device produced today, but it continues to depend on a few open source developers not having a terrible day and deciding to break everything. The library like curl, which is used by millions of devices, is included in everything from your washing machine to your car, but its creator gets tired of supporting it and decides to send a message to the world. What then? We've been lucky in the past that damage could be rolled back, but we might not be so lucky in the future. So, now, to explain a little bit, a lot of modern software development is done in what they call continuous integration. So instead of me keeping the source code to something on my hard drive and having everything saved on my hard drive and then building it out and shipping a compiled package, what a lot of projects do is they'll have all of their code in a repository, you know, like a GitHub or a GitLab, or, you know, even running something locally in their network. And when they push a new version, their integrated development environment will go pull versions of the packages that it depends on, like through NPM or some other packaging system, into the build system and then build out the software so that the libraries are constantly up to date as well. So this is why when this guy pushed these changes to GitHub, all of these projects suddenly pick it up and broke, because they all have automated processes in place to always pull in the latest versions of these libraries. And he did eventually get control of his GitHub account back, because I was following some other articles about this, because I wanted to talk about it on Decking, but I hadn't quite figured out how I wanted to do it yet, because it was all such a mess. But, you know, for a while there, they locked him out of his GitHub account, and even though they acknowledged that it was his, they weren't going to give it back to him, because NPM was saying he had, you know, affected so many people. And this raises a real question. You know, if somebody's an open source developer and they're, you know, putting out their product, they own it, right? They wrote it, they own it. Yeah, sure, they're putting an open source library on or license on it, you know, whether it's Apache or whatever. But in the world of open source, if you don't like what the author of a piece of software is doing with their code, the idea is you grab the last version of it that you didn't have an objection to, and fork it. You take the code as it was at the time you liked it, make a copy of it, start your own repository, and make a new one. We talked about this with Audacity a few months back, where people were fighting over which one was going to be the official fork since they didn't like the company that bought Audacity. But instead, in this case, they didn't do that. Instead, GitHub took over this guy's account and rolled it back for him, and then moved these libraries to be maintained by the community, not him. So they basically took the libraries away from him. Now, I think he did get his GitHub account back, and they've moved it to new hosting, so it's effectively no longer done. But a lot of these NPM packages are not going to some community controlled or company controlled thing. It's just somebody's personal GitHub account, right? They're just pulling in libraries from, you know, somebody who's just thrown it out there. And, of course, for me, from a security standpoint, that's terrifying.
Because
that is horrible.
Well, yeah, because you don't know. What if the account gets compromised? What if the author just doesn't update it for 13 years? What if, you know, they just abandon it? And you've got stuff that's depending on it. And it's like, that's a terrible design. But that's effectively what we have with it, especially with things like NPM and PyPy and a bunch of these other package managers out there. So at least the Linux distros, when they're doing their packages and distributions, you know, they've got package maintainers who go collect the code from wherever it's done and put it in their own package. And, you know, they choose what updates they're going to push out. But most of the programming distros aren't doing that. They're just pulling straight from GitHub or GitLab or wherever the code is posted. And of course, yeah, these guys aren't compensated for their time. It is their product. So if they do want to take a library and just, you know, unpublish it or break it, I mean, it is theirs to do. Right? Yeah.
Like you said, all they can really do is go back to the last functioning one and use that if they can find it.
Well, and that's where it gets weird because, like I said, they kind of just took it away from him, you know, and said, no, this is ours now. And I think it did eventually get resolved, but while it was happening, it's like, oh, no, you've inconvenienced too many people. We're just going to take your property or your intellectual property, and then we'll sort it out later because we can't believe all these people broken. It's like, so where do property rights come in on this, you know?
It's his property to do with what he wants, but he also doesn't have much of a right to complain about not getting paid. He's giving it away for free.
What is that?
Go ahead. Now, I could see his argument of start paying me or I'm going to stop giving it away for free.
Well, I mean, he'd just end up in court.
Stop giving it away for free.
Yeah.
Well, the standing up in court is going to be a problem, especially if he's not being financed now. So he's going to go from not making money to actually losing money, attempting to get back something that has, according to him, no value, even though it's apparently very valuable because many companies use it.
So
yeah, I'd let smarter men than me work it out, man.
Well, I think that's the point. Is it's like if you're comfortable giving it away, again, you're accepting that, you know, it might become massively popular and you're not going to get a dime for it. So that's kind of a risk.
It's going to be more popular than libraries that are being paid for, but it's going to have its own risk. Because I'm assuming if I'm paying for something, it's going to at least be secure, and I'm going to trust the person publishing it because they have a financial interest in it.
Usually you'll have a support contract with them that they're going to support it for X amount of time, right?
Yeah, so. And if I'm getting it for free, I'm taking on the risk of this could stop working next week.
Yeah, and that's the thing.
I don't particularly know who's developing it, and the developer can change.
Well, and what I guess what bothers me most about this particular instance with the two NPM libraries is that GitHub took his repo from him while they were sorting this out. And partially, I understand that because they probably thought his account was hacked because, you know, popular working libraries suddenly replaced with garbage. But if I'm a bad guy, and of course they probably didn't do this level of analysis, but if I'm a bad guy and I get a hold of these libraries, I'm not replacing it with Freedom and breaking the libraries. I'm slipping crypto miners in. I'm you know, backdooring the system some other way. I'm going to do something more than just
going to get paid.
On that, it depends on the bad guy. There are hacktivists.
Well, and that's basically what this guy did, was he hacktivist himself. But well, Psychro says it comes down to GitHub's TOS, and GitHub's Terms of Service says you are not allowed to use their service to cause harm to others, and it's vague enough that they can kind of do whatever they want with that. So, I don't know. I don't like it, but I'm not sure what the answer is. So, let's move on to some comedy. Also, because I looked at the clock, and it's like, oh, we need to get moving. So, RU sent me this one, but it is fucking hilarious. It's from Vice.com. Final Fantasy porn interrupts Italian Senate Zoom event. A video of Tifa Lockhart from Final Fantasy VII having sex appeared on the screen during an event full of politicians and academics. I love how this is written like all of them haven't seen it before. someone crashed a virtual event from the Italian Senate on Monday and streamed 3D porn featuring Final Fantasy characters in front of several politicians, academics, and one Nobel Prize winner. The video featured 3D porn of Final Fantasy VII character Tifa Lockhart getting it from behind. You know, the author was just having fun writing this.
Oh, yeah.
A few seconds of the video played before the speaker realized what was happening and organizers tried to remove the person streaming the video. Quote, about the results of medical and scientific research together with their fast accessibility and reliability, unquote, one speaker says, before Japanese words and moaning interrupt and the porn appears on the screen. I think the sound's probably more interrupting because they have a link at the bottom of the article, so you can see the uncensored video. Anymore. Oh, they pulled it.
How many of those politicians went scrambling, going, fuck, what just opened up in the background?
I thought I closed that porn tab. Fuck.
I guarantee you a few of them had that panic moment. Fuck, can people hear this? Oh, shit, is it me?
Quote, there's a person that has snuck in. I apologize. If the other directors please can help me kick this person out, unquote, one of the event organizers said. Monday's event, held at the Palazzo Giustiniani in the Italian Senate, was titled, quote, for a transparent PA, open data for the political decision maker, unquote. Present were a mix of politicians from Italy's five-star movement party, as well as a physicist and academic Giorgio Pastari, who won the Nobel Prize in 2021 for physics, and several other economics, sociological, and information technology and communications experts, according to local news reports. Senator Maria Laura Mantovani told Italian news outlet Ancronos that she was reporting the incident to the police. Yes, he was giving it to her behind him, not even a reach around. As more events in the last 2 years have moved online for social distancing during the pandemic, Zoom bombing, when someone uninvited gets access to a virtual meeting and then trolls the event with porn or harassment, has become more and more common. So they did pull the video?
Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad. I mean, honestly, it was kind of tame from what I saw. It's like,
find it on Pornhub, probably. I'm not going to look.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of these things of, I mean, it's comedy, but it wasn't like super explicit. You know what I mean?
I'm just sad that governments aren't more secure than this.
Well, I mean, they're probably using a fucking free Zoom account, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, put a password on the damned thing. And, well, of course, when you're going to do a wide audience one, you know, all it takes is one person forwarding or accidentally letting slip what the meeting invite is, I guess. But the other thing you can do, which helps a lot with Zoom bombs, especially when people are just guessing URLs, is once you have all of the normal attendees in the meetings, at least in WebEx and a few others, you can lock it so no attendees can come in without approval. On Teams, at least, you can actually, you know, put it in a mode where everyone has to be approved before you let them in. So, you know, granted, again, this still comes down to you basically need a dedicated person to sit there and watch the event list and make sure it matches who's supposed to be there. But, and, you know, I mean, there are ways to handle this if you're a larger institution, not just somebody using a free Zoom account.
What's the Italian Senate? I'm thinking they're all going to be logging in from official email accounts. So just look, did Mario from Italy.gov log in? Okay, he's good. That's an AOL account. That's not allowed in. Wait a minute. It's an AOL account. We'll let that one in. The Gmail one. That one's
Hang on.
Not getting
Big Daddy
in.
Dick is not a registered email. What are we doing? Either way, it was a little bit of fun.
I mean, comedy. I mean, you got to give him props for comedy.
I mean, for all this shit that's going on, at least there's something funny.
Well, continuing the theme of comedy, this last article is from Bitdefender, and I'm just reading this so we can make fun of it. 9-year-old kids are launching DDoS attacks against schools.
I was sad until just now because I thought our education system was going downhill. But if we've educated 9-year-olds to the point where they know what the fuck a DDoS attack is,
Oh, it get this
I'm
article.
I'm less sad.
This article gets better, Madman. You'll enjoy it. Britain's computer crime cops are targeting youngsters as young as 9 years old in an attempt to dissuade them from embarking on a life of cybercrime. There it is. The UK's National Crime Agency has launched a new initiative with the hopes of educating youngsters. Who the fuck writes youngsters these days? Of the consequences of launching DDoS attacks. A study by the NCA's National Cybercrime Unit discovered that the number of distributed denial-of-service attacks launched against school networks and websites has more than doubled from 2019 to 2020. No shit. According to the NCCU, many of the referrals were secondary school children, with the average being 15 years old and the youngest just 9. One theory is that youngsters can fall into denial-of-service attacks. Okay, here we go. Let's get the gasp ready.
Strap in.
Yeah.
All into
or
it.
Strap on.
Oh, yeah. Here we go, Mebin. One theory is that youngsters can fall into denial of service attacks by firstly playing online games, then falling into installing mods, hacks, and then even remote access Trojans to get the upper hands on their gaming rifles. It's like we went from a water gun to a Nerf gun to an AR-15. Wait a minute, what the fuck? I think you skipped some steps there. I mean, at least
hot coffee mod has led me to attacking my school.
It's like, what the fuck? I mean, seriously, am I not the only one who thinks, wait a minute, what the hell?
All I wanted to do was turn all the dragons in Skyrim into Thomas the Train. I didn't know what was going to lead me to taking down the Fae.
Research has suggested that many young students do not consider it wrong to disrupt other players' gaming experience because it's considered just another way to win. Their peers are doing it too, and they certainly do not believe that they're likely to get in any trouble with the law. So how can the police convince youngsters they shouldn't launch attacks against others, whether it be fellow gamers or school websites? The initiative rolled out by the NCA to over 2,000 primary and secondary schools in the UK ahead of going live at further schools and colleges across the country will see students who search for terms associated with cybercrime greeting with an access denied block page. Oh no, they're doing a keyword block. It's not like they haven't been doing that since the 90s.
Hold up. They think people are actually doing denial of service attacks to get an advantage in Overwatch.
I mean, I prefer to SWAT my enemies, man. I'm just not as sophisticated as a British child.
A faggot and teabagging me when I'm dead. That's what the fuck they do to piss me off.
The warning message aims to direct students to the Cyber Choices website, which provides information about the Computer Misuse Act and the consequences of breaking cybercrime laws. They've got a video in here. We're not going to play it because it looks fucking dumb, but it's up there with copy. Don't copy that floppy. So maybe it's not quite as epic.
Won't even sell a spoon to a child under the age of 18.
It's not quite up there with don't copy that floppy, but when I watched it earlier, it's just like, oh my God. It's not just a warning about those who search for stressor or booter services, which provide an easy way to launch a DDoS attack against the school network. The campaign also aims to influence young people who might be considering engaging in cybercrime to feel motivated to exploit their technical prowess in an ethical career in technology, gaming, or cybersecurity. And hey, don't put my industry into this shit. An NCA video explains to youngsters that a legitimate career, such as a job as a junior game developer, could yield a salary of £35,000 a year. Okay, no junior game developer. One, £35,000 a year is not that much. But two, junior game developers making that? I'm sorry, so many people want in that industry that you're not going to make shit. Security industry, actually, you will make money, but launching a DDoS attack probably help you get in that one, now that I think about it. Anyways, but launching a DDoS attack could result in a police visit or a ban on accessing the internet and a seizure of computing equipment. Oh, no, don't take my Apple, too.
Dude, if that was my kid and the cops came to the door, I'd laugh at him, tell him to fuck off. much y'all get taken to CPS then?
Psychro says that's almost as much as they could make in food service. Yeah, I was going to say that's not a very enticing number there. Hopefully, initiatives like this will help some youngsters avoid taking the first steps into a life of cybercrime. Like what, playing a fucking video game? For real?
Yeah, it's like $48,000 a year.
Yeah, that's not that much for a developer. I'm sorry. So, I mean, my opinion on this is obvious. You all go ahead if you have anything, or we'll go into decking or dojo.
Ridiculous.
I think they're blaming the wrong people when it comes to DDoSing them. I think it might be pissed off parents. I don't believe children are getting involved in this. Except maybe if they have really, really bad login portals, and it's not that they're DDoSing, it's that they're legitimately trying to log in, and you just can't support the numbers. That's not a DDoS
attack. That happens.
That's bad infrastructure.
All right, let's do this. So what I have for us tonight for Digital Dojo is a open source, self-hostable AI server. So it's specifically for doing object detection in images. So it does face recognition, face detection, common object detection, scene recognition, and you can give it custom objects and faces to try to match up. Most people are using it with security systems, but you know, it's an open platform. It's got an API. They've got, you know, libraries for Python, for JavaScript, for C#. And it is open source, although you have to kind of hunt around to find the open source link on their page there to get to their GitHub. But it's designed to be deployed in Docker, so you could theoretically build a swarm of, like, old machines or put video cards in it and be able to kind of pool the resources to make it faster. And because it's exposed as an API, you could then... You know, you could have a server in the corner running this thing, and then like a Raspi that's feeding it the camera feed and calling it to do things, you know, based on what you want it to do. So it's kind of a cool project if you're into playing with AI, and the fact that it's, you know, free and you can just spin it. They've got some pretty good documentation on spinning it up and how to do some basics with it. That a good place to start if you're wanting to play with this kind of thing. So...
I can do home automation.
Yeah, you absolutely could.
Not that I need my refrigerator talking to me. I'm going to forget what I need at the grocery store all by myself.
You just start getting texts from the grocery store telling you to remember to buy the Zima. It's like, what is in this thing? I don't know if Zima's still made anymore, but I just thought that was a
fun Your lunch meat's attempting to run away. It's time to replace it.
Milk's gone bad. It's been arrested. All right. I'm out of jokes on that. Are you have anything? I guess we should close it out correctly here. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working up peer decking every Thursday. The Galaxy 15 radio site and subreddit. Are you closing thoughts?
I don't really have any this week. Yeah, that's going to be my closing thought. I don't have anything.
Fair enough. Madman, closing thoughts.
We shouldn't outsource logging in to pay your fucking taxes. I don't want my info in more places than necessary. The IRS already has my info because they need it for me to pay my taxes. They can handle their own fucking login server.
All right.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Now just go nose down and call it a night.
I'm going to be honest with you. I'm kind of retarded.
Shut up, Wesley.
Oop, I hit the wrong button. Switch over to the broadcast box so I can actually stop broadcasting.